This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها منه ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister condemns the recent sabotage attack on the country's Natanz enrichment facility as nuclear terrorism and a war crime. Russia slams the U.S. for its military activities in and around Ukraine as tensions escalate between Moscow and Kiev. Also, Black Lives Matter protesters defy a curfew in a Minneapolis suburb and take to the streets for a second night after the fatal shooting of a black man by a U.S. police officer. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran has slammed the recent sabotage incident at its Natanz facility as nuclear terrorism and a war crime. In a letter addressed to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said the attack on the safeguarded facility risked releasing radioactive material into the environment. He added Israel, that threatened to prevent the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, is now boasting about its actions after the U.S. election. Iran's top diplomat also urged Washington to cease what he called economic terrorism against Iran as a negotiating leverage. He reiterated Iran's stance in the nuclear deal, saying the country would stop its remedial measures only after all sanctions are removed. Political commentator Mark Weber says the U.S. would risk its international reputation if it gives the green light to Israel for carrying out sabotage attacks similar to the one at Iran's Natanz facility. Let's listen.
But this is dangerous because the Biden administration wants very much for the United States to play as it believes its rightful place in the world as a world leader. And if it allows these incidents to detract from that, if it goes along with Israel in this, it becomes very difficult for the United States to be any kind of leader role in the world because it's not trusted by the world community. And most importantly, the attitude in Europe will continue to be one, or increasingly one, of distrust of the United States as any kind of reliable partner. The United States is obliged under the by the JCPOA agreement, which was ratified as a United Nations Security Council resolution, to abide by all of its provisions. It's not allowed to quibble or negotiate or try to renegotiate the agreement. And Europe knows this. The world knows this. And so the Biden administration attempt to sort of quibble the thing, it only shows the United States a lack of sincerity, a lack of real will to act in accord with international law. And if that's going to be the position of the new Biden administration, that it can't play an effective role as it would like to as a so-called world leader.
Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says Israel and its allies are responsible for the act of sabotage at the country's Natanz nuclear facility. Qasem Gharibabadi said Israel's role in the attack is absolutely clear. He also called on the IAEA to condemn the act of terrorism and hold a session to discuss the incident. The Iranian envoy criticized the agency for failing to fulfill its responsibilities toward Iran. Gharibabadi said Iran is installing centrifuges at the Natanz facility, which are more advanced than the previous ones. Elsewhere, Iran's mission to the European Union called on the bloc to strongly condemn the incident as a threat to international peace and security.
Israel has made no secret of its hostility toward Iran since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, which led to the ouster of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi monarchy. Israel, which is also a fierce opponent of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, has been behind the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the past years. On Sunday, Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in the central province of Isfahan was hit by a power outage. Israeli media confirmed that the Mossad spy agency carried out a cyber attack on the site. Iran also blamed the Israeli regime for the incident.
What happened in Natanz was a bold act of nuclear terrorism on Iranian soil. It can be considered under the category of crimes against humanity, which the Israeli regime has been doing that for many years now.
Said Khatibzadeh stressed that the incident will not slow down the country's nuclear program, rather it will speed up its advancement. He said the IR-1 centrifuges damaged in the blackout will be replaced with more advanced ones. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif also accused Israel of sabotaging the Natanz facility and pledged revenge against Tel Aviv for the attack. Zarif suggested that the attack was an attempt to derail the talks held in the Austrian capital with the aim of reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. The European Union also said the incident in Natanz could have been an act of sabotage and warned against any attempts to derail the JCPOA talks, which will resume on Wednesday in Vienna between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal.
And the bottom line for us is that we are saying that we are rejecting any attempts to undermine or to derail the ongoing diplomatic activities to try to resolve all the open questions regarding Iranian nuclear deal. We try to resolve them through diplomatic means currently in Vienna in the ongoing process of talks and negotiations of the parties of the JCPOA and through our contacts with the United States.
Russia also expressed hope that the attack on the Iranian nuclear facility will not undermine the Vienna negotiations. The Sunday attack came as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin was in Israel for talks with Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed to do everything in his power to stop efforts for salvaging the JCPOA. U.S. media say Washington, which is Israel's closest ally, was not involved in the attack on the Natanz facility, but the timing of Austin's trip has raised doubts about the claim. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has stressed that Tehran cannot trust promises made by the new U.S. administration regarding the revival of the JCPOA. Now the attack on the Natanz nuclear facility can deepen the distrust as the incident further questions the sincerity of such promises.
Political commentator Michael Jones says Israel's act of sabotage against the Iranian nuclear facility shows that it is the main sponsor of terrorism.
Once again, confirmed our belief that the main source of state-sponsored terrorism is Israel. So the question is, the whole world condemns this act. What are they going to do about it? The first challenge is going to be to the United States. This is a test of the Biden administration. Is Biden in charge here? Or all those dual citizens in his cabinet, are they running the show? Like the Secretary of State, all the people who have dual citizenship with Israel. This is a direct challenge to Mr. Biden. It's a direct challenge to the United States of America. It's an attack on Iran, but that's where the real challenge lies.
Russia's foreign minister is in Iran for talks on expanding bilateral relations. Sergey Lavrov has met with his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif, after he arrived in the capital, Tehran. Before the meeting, the top Russian diplomat said his visit is aimed at discussing future ties between the two countries. Iranian officials have said two agreements will be signed, including one on a mutual action plan for cooperation. Russia is a signatory to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The two nations also have close cooperation in Syria. Russia has slammed the U.S. for its military activities in and around Ukraine as tensions escalate between Moscow and Kiev.
We are asked what the Russian Federation is doing on the border with Ukraine. The answer is very simple. We live here. It's our country. What is the United States doing in the form of their ships, their military personnel, who constantly organize some kind of events alongside the NATO, thousands of kilometers from their own territory? This question remains unanswered so far.
Sergei Lavrov also warned against what he called fueling belligerent sentiments in Ukraine. His comments come as the U.S. is planning to send two of its warships to the Black Sea this week. Earlier, the G7 foreign ministers urged Russia to stop what they called provocations over its military buildup near Ukraine's border. This is why Russia has accused Ukraine of provocative measures near its border. Recently, Ukraine demanded NATO speed up the country's membership plan, heating up tensions with the Kremlin. Russia and Ukraine have had a long-standing conflict centered on Crimea and Donbas region. Moscow is also at odds with NATO over the eastward expansion of the military alliance. Moving on. Police in the U.S. state of Tennessee have shot dead a high school student after he allegedly opened fire on them.
The Knoxville Police Department received a report of an individual that was possibly armed with a gun at Austin East High School. Upon arrival, officers located the individual in the school in a restroom. They ordered him out, but he refused to comply. As officers entered the space, the subject reportedly fired shots, striking an officer. One officer returned fire. The suspect was pronounced dead at the scene.
The official added that the injured officer is in serious condition after being hit with a bullet in his upper leg. The high school in Knoxville will remain closed for 2 days following the Monday shooting. City officials say four other students at the same school have been shot dead in the past few months since mid-March. At least a dozen people have lost their lives in shootings across the U.S. A cardiologist has testified on the 11th day of the trial of white police officer Derek Chauvin, who killed African-American George Floyd. Jonathan Rich says the man died due to low oxygen levels, not drug overdose.
Mr. George Floyd died from a cardiopulmonary arrest. It was caused by low oxygen levels, and those low oxygen levels were induced by the prone restraint and positional asphyxiation that he was subjected to. After reviewing all of the facts and evidence of the case, I can state with a high degree of medical certainty that George Floyd did not die from a primary cardiac event, and he did not die from a drug overdose.
Floyd's death was preventable.
Rich added that Floyd's death was absolutely preventable. The white officer is charged with murdering the 46-year-old man. He was captured on video kneeling on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes before he stopped breathing. That happened in May 2020 and sparked massive protests against police brutality and racial injustice in the U.S. The U.S. city of Minneapolis has declared a state of emergency amid growing anger over another fatal shooting of an African-American man by a white officer. The Minneapolis mayor also declared an 11-hour curfew starting from 7 p.m. The city has been the scene of clashes between Black Lives Matter demonstrators and police. President Joe Biden has urged people to remain peaceful in their protest. Anger is boiling after a video emerged showing Dante Wright being fatally shot by an officer while being arrested for a traffic violation in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota on Sunday. The police say the gunshot was fired by accident.
As I watched the video and listened to the officer's commands, it is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet. This appears to me, from what I viewed and the officer's reaction in distress immediately after, that this was an accidental discharge that resulted in the tragic death of Mr. Wright. I'm also stressing that I do hope for the community to be patient.
The police chief added that the officer is placed on administrative leave while investigations into the incident are underway. Several instances of police brutality against African Americans have sent shockwaves across the U.S. They have sparked protests calling for police reforms. Health officials across Europe have recorded more than a million deaths since the outbreak of the novel coronavirus as the disease continues to wreak havoc on the continent. The death toll in Europe is the highest of any global region, with several countries reporting a surge in infections and deaths. Britain reported the highest number of new cases since April, with more than 3,500 infections. The latest figures push the country's total cases to over 4.3 million and more than 127,000 deaths. In France, the number of patients in intensive care units has risen to a new 2021 record of nearly 6,000. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has expressed concern over the surge in cases and deaths.
This pandemic is a long way from over, but we have many reasons for optimism. The decline in cases and deaths during the first 2 months of the year shows that this virus and its variants can be stopped. We have now seen 7 consecutive weeks of increasing cases and 4 weeks of increasing deaths. Last week was the 4th highest number of cases in a single week so far.
Provided in 6 official UN languages.
The WHO also warned that the trajectory of the pandemic is growing exponentially. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains to be the world's worst hit country by the pandemic. Officials in the U.S. have so far reported over 562,000 deaths out of more than 31.2 million confirmed cases. In Brazil, the world's second worst hit in terms of deaths, authorities reported over 35,000 new cases and nearly 1,500 more deaths. The South American nation's caseload now stands at more than 13.5 million and deaths over 354,000. India has set the world's highest daily tally of new COVID cases for a second day in a row. The country reported nearly 162,000 new infections in 24 hours. Its total case tally is now above 13.6 million. That's the second largest in the world after the U.S. India overtook Brazil in terms of total infections just on Monday. Cases surged following a decline in January and February. Indian authorities have blamed the jump on huge crowds and people's reluctance to wear masks. India's tally is on course to double in 2 months. That's according to estimates based on data from U.S.-based Johns Hopkins University. A senior former British civil servant says the UK's 300-year-old union is in deep crisis, citing a lack of strategy by the government. Philip Rycroft says Britain's future is also in doubt due to what he called deep-rooted complacency from Westminster. Ahmed Caballo has more in this report from London.
Increasing the number of
Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. That is a fact. But according to a senior former British civil servant, Philip Rycroft, the COVID-19 pandemic has seeded the idea of a Prime Minister who speaks for England alone. In a study looking at the issues of devolution from inside the UK state machinery, the former permanent secretary to the Brexit department stated that the 300-year-old union is in deep peril due to no defined strategy by Westminster.
In the context of COVID, where each of the constituent nations' devolved governments are essentially self-governing, this has inculcated a sense that Britain is not a unified nation, the UK is not unified, and it's never been more divided and never been more angry. And to all intents, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson, at least unofficially, is the Prime Minister of England only. He doesn't seem to care about the union.
The crisis has been exacerbated amid growing momentum for a second referendum on Scottish independence, with a recent poll showing that pro-independence parties would win 79 of 129 seats in Holyrood in the upcoming elections. Moreover, there's also a growing independence movement in Wales that will add to Westminster's woes. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland, there's been a serious deterioration of relations between the nationalist and loyalist communities following the implementation of the Brexit deal, which has resulted in some of the worst street violence to have taken place in recent years.
I think Northern Ireland has been used as a pawn. It's been used as a pawn by the British government. It's been used as a pawn by the European Union.
The report, co-authored by Professor Michael Kenny, claimed it was political decision-making made by Westminster, mixed with a lack of consultation with dissolved governments and confused messaging that has caused widening divisions, with Rycliffe claiming that Boris Johnson's muscular brand of unionism had asserted the value of the union rather than demonstrating it.
Boris Johnson and his crew of hard right ideologues have substituted flag-waving British nationalism for clear-headed policy designed to make people in different parts of the UK feel they're part of something united rather than increasingly polarised. And when the flag-waving starts, the thinking stops. And when the thinking stops, the road to ruin is set. And this UK is on a road to ruin.
The warnings laid out in this new report are stark. Unless there's a change in strategy from Downing Street, then the future of the United Kingdom as four nations, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, is in doubt. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Well, that's your world news.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The Prophet's Sermon on the Advent of Ramadan. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. Salam and wish you lots of spiritual bounties on the threshold of the blessed Ramadan. Today we present you a sermon by the Prophet of Islam on the blessings of the month of fasting. In the book Uyun Akhbarul Ridha, compiled over 1,000 years ago by the famous Iranian theologian and scholar Sheikh Sadugh, the Prophet's eighth infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, relates on the chain of authority of his illustrious ancestors from the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, peace upon him, that once, on the advent of the blessed month of Ramadan, the Prophet, addressing the people, delivered the following sermon. Stay with us, please. O people, the month of Allah has come with its mercies, blessings, and forgiveness. Allah has decreed this month, the best of all months, its days, the best of all days, its nights, the best of all nights, and its hours, the best of all hours. It is the month in which He has invited you. He has honored you in it. Every breath you take in it has the reward of tasbih, glorification of Allah. Your sleep is worship. Your good deeds are accepted and your invocations are answered. Therefore, you must invoke your Lord in right earnest with hearts that are free from sin and evil, and pray that Allah may help you keep fast and recite the Quran. Indeed, miserable is the one who is deprived of Allah's forgiveness in this great month. While fasting, visualize the hunger and thirst of the Day of Judgment. Give alms to the poor and the needy. Pay respect to your elders. Have sympathy for your youngsters and be kind towards your relatives and kinsmen. Guard your tongue against unworthy words, your eyes from sins not worth seeing, and your ears from sounds that should not be heard. Be kind to orphans, so that if your children were to become orphans, they would also be treated with kindness. Do repent to Allah for your sins and supplicate with raised hands at times of prayers, as these are the best of times during which Almighty Allah looks at His servants with mercy, answers if they supplicate, responds if they call, grants if they ask, and accepts if they entreat. O people, you have made your conscience the slave of your desires. Make it free by invoking Him for forgiveness. Your back is breaking under the heavy load of your sins. So prostrate before him for long intervals and make it lighter. Do understand fully well that Allah has promised in the name of His Majesty and honor that He will not take to task such people who perform the prayers and the prostrations, and that He will guard their bodies against the fire of hell on the day of judgment. O pupil, if anybody from amongst you arranges for the iftar or the breaking of fast of any believers, then Allah will give the reward as if he or she had set free a slave, and He will forgive previous sins. When the audience asked, "But not everyone amongst us has the ability to arrange for the iftar," the Prophet replied, "Keep yourself away from the fire of hell, though it may consist of only half a date or even some water if you have nothing else." The Prophet, in continuation of his sermon, said, "O people, anybody who in this month cultivates good manners will walk over the Sirat, the bridge leading to paradise via the rim of hell, on the day when feet will tend to slip. Anybody who in this month may take light work from servants, Allah will make easy his accounting, and anybody who does not annoy others in it, Allah will keep him safe from His wrath on the Day of Judgment. Whoever respects and treats an orphan with kindness in it, Allah shall look at him with kindness on that day. Anyone who treats well kinsfolk in it, Allah will bestow His mercy on him on the Day of Judgment. While anybody who maltreats kinsfolk in it, Allah will deprive him of His majesty. Whoever offers recommended prayers in it, Allah will save him from hell, and whoever observes in it obligatory acts of worship, the reward will be sevenfold for such acts compared to other months. Whoever repeatedly recites salawat on me in it, Allah will keep the scales of good deeds heavy, whilst the scales of others would be tending to lightness. In this month, whoever recites an ayah of the Quran, the reward will be that of reciting the whole Quran in other months. O people, the gates of paradise remain open in this month. Do pray to your Lord that they may not be closed for you. While the gates of hell are closed, do pray to your Lord that they may never be opened for you. Satans have been handcuffed, so invoke your Lord not to let them dominate you." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "I asked, O Messenger of Allah, what are the best deeds in this month?" The Prophet replied, "O Abu al-Hasan, the best of deeds in this month is to be far from what Allah has forbidden." The Imam, seeing the Prophet in grief, asked, O Messenger of Allah, what makes you weep? In reply, the Prophet foretold the tragedy that was to befall Imam Ali peace upon him decades later in Ramadan. O Ali, I weep for that which will befall you in this month. To be in your place when you will be praying to your Lord, and the most wicked person of all times, like the one who chopped off the feet of the camel of Thamud, will strike you, and your head and your beard will be dyed in blood. On being informed of his martyrdom, the first thought that occurred to Imam Ali peace upon him was not about the life of this mortal world, but about his faith, and he asked, O Messenger of Allah, will my faith be secure? The Prophet replied, yes, your faith will be secure. Then the Prophet continued his sermon as his companions listened in amazement and some in disbelief. O Ali, whoever kills you has killed me. Whoever annoys you has annoyed me. And whoever slanders you has slandered me, because you are to me like my soul. Your spirit is my spirit, and your nature is my nature. Surely Allah the Praised and the Glorious created me, then you, chose me, then you, and selected me for prophethood, and selected you for imamat. Whoever denies your imamat has denied my prophethood. O Ali, you are my legatee and father of my children and husband of my daughter and my vicegerent over my ummah, both in my lifetime and after my death. Your bidding is my bidding, and your forbidding is my forbidding. By the power that granted me prophethood and made me the most excellent of creation, you are the proof of Allah over his creatures, and his trustee over mysteries, and his caliph over his creatures.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Who rules America?
Hot Bowl.
From the earliest days, freedom of the press was what defined America. Thomas Jefferson, who helped write the Declaration of Independence, believed a free media was essential for a free nation, saying, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." That was in 1787. Today, our newspapers seem to be fading in importance in a multimedia world that is largely owned and controlled by a handful of large media corporations.
I think we're probably the most media-dominated society in the world.
Jeff Cohn worked in major media. Now he's one of the industry's fiercest critics.
Half a dozen corporations own and control most of the mainstream media in our country. So if you're looking at who rules America or who owns America, it's the same people that propagandize to America.
The press and the outlets that report news or convey information are just a small slice of vast media empires producing entertainment products that also sell a way of life based on consumption.
When you look at who's on the boards of media corporations, they're also on the boards of U.S. oil companies, and they're on the boards of U.S. military contractors. So trying to study who owns America, you're really also, these are the people that own the media. We don't have a state media, but in some ways it's very much like a state media. It's the corporate state.
If this is true, then we can say that the American media doesn't just report news. As we'll see, it's not independent of the system, but a pillar of it. It reinforces the worldview and defends the interests of those who rule America. With new global digital enterprises like Google, Facebook, and Twitter growing in importance worldwide, U.S.-based media became a transnational force. The U.S. media companies are themselves owned in large part by hedge funds, mutual funds, and finance companies. Barry James Dyke is an asset manager who has studied media ownership.
The research which I've done is unequivocal, and I kind of stumbled into this, is that The media companies, the major media companies, i.e. the Disneys, the CBSs, the news corporations, all of them, this is all public documents, is that they're all owned by mutual fund companies. The majority shareholders are owned by mutual fund companies. So, and also, they also get a lot of their revenue from these companies. So you're never going to see any consistent criticism about these fund companies.
Are these companies investigated by the media?
No, they're not.
Are they responsible to the public in some way? Are they accountable? Do the public really know what they're doing?
The public really doesn't have a clue. They really don't know what they're doing.
He has documented his findings with charts in his own book, The Pirates of Manhattan.
Well, people are not going to begin not getting the truth.
What about the role of the media? Is the media helping to strengthen our democracy, or do you think it's helping to divide us?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, there are a couple of things going on there. Obviously, you've got kind of cable channels that are, you know, in different camps, and they are not showing different points of view. You've got Fox News showing the right. You've got MSNBC showing the left. And so with a setup like that, you have Americans that are just kind of tuning in to the channel they want to listen to that, you know, kind of expresses their views, and you're not seeing kind of a mix of an opinion, a debate, anything like that. You've also got, you know, the shrinkage of the media. You've got less coverage of what's going on. And I think this is particularly concerning more around kind of state-based and local politics, where there's even less coverage of what's going on in politics.
But even as the world is known for its diversity, American media is not. Editorially and ideologically, the power elite tends to reflect the views of the government and the people who shape its views. Dissenting politicians like Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. have a hard time getting their views heard.
Who owns the media? How the media is translated? Some of the moguls and the titans of media and industry are part of the problem. They shape a narrative for the American people, a narrative that ultimately leads millions of people to vote for candidates based upon the narrative that they shape, based upon the talking heads that they control. And those Americans tend to vote and tend to engage the system on the basis of that which they hear. Media is a significant part of this problem.
Historian Eric Foner agrees. He says it's not just political bias at work, but what the media as a business feels it's forced to focus on to attract ratings and revenues.
Somehow, that idea of power behind the people in office is not really in our media very much. It's not really in people's minds very much. They personalize politics. Their personalities combating each other, but they don't look at who's behind the scenes.
Well, you're quite right that the media focuses on personalities, you know, and often the quirks of personality, Clinton's sexual escapades, or whether Obama was born in the United States or not, or Romney and his cars and whatever, you know, his not paying taxes and many other things. Those are not totally unimportant issues, but maybe it's the nature of the media today in and of itself, in that it you know, it has to go for the quick news. Deep investigative reporting is not emphasized as much as perhaps it was in the past. And, you know, you got to sell papers, and scandal sells papers, personality sells papers, celebrity sells papers. So you're right that, the larger nature of how the system operates tends not to get emphasized as much.
It's not even understood by many people.
Well, it's hard to understand. This is a very large country, over 300 million people, a very, very complicated economy and political system, so it's difficult to understand exactly how things operate. But I think, you know, in a certain sense, the anti-government sentiment, which is rife in this country, which is generally associated with the right wing, is also a response to the feeling. It's an inchoate feeling. It's not an analytical feeling, but it's a feeling that government is aloof. It is not responsive. It does not really represent the people. It represents some very particular interests, and that sense is pretty widespread in this country.
Media watch groups are also concerned about the lack of diversity within the media that makes it unrepresentative of the country it serves in racial, ethnic, and gender terms.
The unwritten credo of the New York Times is do not alienate those for whom we depend on for money and access.
Chris Hedges was an award-winning journalist for the New York Times, an American media star.
And that means the power elite and the financiers who advertise. But it's expandable. I mean, you have at least in the positions that I was in, the possibility to do journalism. Not that there aren't, you know, restrictions or constrictions. There are, and not that they can't be punishing.
Hedges' work is still very respected, but he believes that much of the press is ultimately a charade that covers up for power more than covers it, especially when reporting on elections.
Because the political theater, I mean, the personal narrative of the candidate, it's all irrelevant. It's meaningless. And people, we still play the game. Look, every totalitarian country I covered had elections. They all play the charade. I mean, even East Germany did. And that's the charade we play. And when we have a compliant corporate media that pretends that that charade is real. So I think the problem is that the illusion still remains so powerful. But people are changing, but the illusion is still so powerful that people confuse where power actually exists.
How does the New York Times cover the power centers that many people say rule America? Chris Spanos edits the New York Times Examiner that monitors the newspaper's content every day. He believes the paper has become an accomplice to the power elite.
The New York Times as an institution is almost like a mini nation, and the correspondents, the op-ed writers, the editors, they're almost like diplomats in how they carry themselves and their own self-importance in the way that they communicate with other politicians and diplomats, and they are very influential.
Would you say that they're a disseminator of ideology in America, not just of information?
Absolutely. They disseminate a very particular ideology, and that their readership is primarily managers and people who make around over $90,000 a year, and so they cater to a managerial perspective, and so they have a pro-management when they're discussing labor relations. They often have a pro-management view, a pro-business view.
Financial journalists like Stacey Herbert and Max Kaiser found that many pro-business views in some media outlets were often uninformed, as they told me on a radio show.
From December 2008, so well after the collapse of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, the markets tumbling 1,000 points in a day, and the head of BBC World News Business said, and we had a 10-episode contract, do you think the financial crisis will last all the way through these 10 episodes?
So in other words, the people actually in charge of planning the coverage are very uninformed themselves.
Well, the mainstream media are themselves deeply in debt. You know, the news organizations have become entertainified, and to compete, they take on enormous amounts of debt. So the bankers, they don't want to insult their creditors because they might cut off their lines of credit. So they don't have, they're not unbiased in this regard in any stretch of the imagination. You see this most spectacularly with the New York Times. Their coverage of the Wall Street is pitiful.
Welcome to my world.
One reason the press is so pro-business is that they are themselves businesses. The people who run media companies increasingly pay themselves huge salaries and bonuses, the same way that bankers do, says Barry Dyke.
Yeah, Les Moonves, I couldn't believe it. He made $59 million in 2009, and he racked up, it was just disclosed the other day, that he made close to $70 million in 2010.
And that's the head of CBS.
That's the head of CBS.
But you're saying that all of them are really running their businesses as if they were banks.
I mean, that's pretty good. That's banker pay. I mean, $70 million is a lot of money in anyone's book. And that's what they're getting paid.
So the media companies are really part of this whole system of who rules America. They're part of these interlocking relationships with financial institutions.
There's no question about it. You get the media companies, which are huge. It's part of the empire. You get the media companies. You get the bankers, of course. You have your massive, unions. Okay, you have other factors as well. But the media is definitely part of it, and the asset managers.
That's exactly it. The corporations that own the U.S. media and own U.S. television are very wealthy and very powerful. And the people at the top of the news networks get paid an awful lot of money. I have never earned anything close to the amount of money I earned in the 1 year I worked where General Electric was my boss at MSNBC. So what I think happens is a self-censorship where the people who rise to the top have learned how not to rock any boats. And they know if they do rock boats, they will lose their huge salaries.
Newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal tend to frame a deeper narrative that tells us what we should believe matters. They set the agenda that influences what TV news programs also cover. For example, they don't focus on inequality and class differences, says independent media executive Brian Drolle.
They don't talk about the working class. And part of it is, it's like the idea that, they promote this idea that, if you buy a lottery ticket, you could win, right? So you're already thinking that maybe you could win. So if you're in the working class or you're part of the working class that's unemployed, you still have this hope that somehow you're going to go into the middle class.
There's been very little attention paid to class. I mean, you were saying that the media really doesn't discuss this. They don't really highlight class differences in America. They're much more comfortable talking about racial differences or ethnic differences. At the same time, in their business practices, they're very conscious of demographics. What class are they attracting? Upper class, how to cater their advertising, how to sell it.
No, they go, the internet is a perfect example of that. Google, everything, where they're constantly slicing and dicing who you are, so they know exactly how much you make, so they can pitch what kind of products to you. But that's this whole sort of madness of the consumer society that's been created by modern capitalism. But the key thing I think that you're getting at is that even though there is a reality of class, a working class in this country, and a ruling class or a bourgeois class, people have been trained not to think in those terms, so they don't even know who they are.
Some networks, like Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch, seem to be more comfortable presenting a right-wing political line. They have helped shift many media outlets to the right.
There is a school of thought that says we should have given the citizens of Baghdad 48 hours to get out of Dodge and flatten the place. Then the war would be already over, and we could have done that in 2 days.
That may be so, but old media is being eclipsed by the new, says George Scribner, the vice president of Digitas, a company that comes up with digital strategies for big companies and studies how affluent consumers now drive marketing in an era of growing economic inequality.
The one thing that's different now is that the media is owned by everyone. The thing that's kind of leveling off the dollars to some extent is that everyone has access to Twitter. Everyone has access to blogging. And there's this new kind of fast and fluid coalition building. Like Occupy Wall Street was one example of that. So in some ways, kind of there's a new check and balance. I don't think that's necessarily changing the restructuring of income and wealth, but I do think there's another trip switch that might help us when things get too bad.
So the digital media, in a
yes.
way, is where democracy
exactly.
is today. It's not in politics.
Yes.
It's not in big business. It's not in big money.
That's true. I think that's well said.
There is some debate on how free the internet really is, given corporate control and government censorship, but it does make possible more interactivity. At the same time, media attention still tends to revolve around a political elite with authority, even if that elite doesn't necessarily have the power to shape priorities or impose policies. But when you talk to ordinary Americans, many of them feel it's totally fair.
Yeah.
They're seeing different points of view. They're seeing people who are critical from time to time. They're, you know, they see the media as the liberal media in some instances.
I was in the Soviet Union, and we were always raised in this country that's pure propaganda. And frankly, it was very ineffective propaganda because they never pretended to have two points of view. They would have one point of view saying how great things are. But in our country, propaganda is really effective because they have the appearance of debate.
Media does not often cover the people behind the scenes who run things, says William Hartung, who has written about the military-industrial complex.
You would think there would be some independence in the journalism on this issue. But in some cases, reporters have even said to me, well, you know, I can't go after the Pentagon harder or the companies harder. Or this nexus of influence harder because this company is a big advertiser in the paper, and we'll get pressure, you know, if we do those kinds of stories. So we'll do stories about the war in Afghanistan. We'll repeat what the president has to say on an issue, but there's not really a lot of interest or resources put into investigating these kinds of connections.
David Swanson, who also writes about military policy, agrees.
Well, the corporate media in the United States is integrated with the military-industrial complex. Some of the same corporations are making profits from both. There are two major political parties that don't have much disagreement on this topic, so it's not a topic for debate. No matter if 90% of the public is upset about it, it's not acceptable news.
Michael Clare, who's investigated the destructive power of oil and gas companies, says the same is true when it comes to that industry.
The media doesn't cover this for the most part. In fact, the media is largely in league because of the advertising dollars that the oil and gas lobby provides. They're very heavily dependent on advertising revenue, so they're very careful in what they say.
Big business, a wealthy and frequent advertiser in the media, is often not scrutinized by the media. That was the case in the financial crisis, says Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics.
So these are complicated issues. The issues are difficult to understand on a good day, and they seem, again, very arcane and unimportant to the average American. So it's possible that some media were laboring away trying to explain why this was critical information that the voters need. I think a lot of blame, though, can be laid at the feet of the media for the financial collapse. Ultimately, what we do know is that it's critical. If there's any perfect scenario that shows why transparency and paying attention and scrutinizing the powerful players and what they want and what they're doing to get their way, the financial crisis is that perfect example. It shows us how important transparency is.
Because significant wealth demands significant attention. Together we can give you and your wealth the wings to soar. Goldman Sachs Wealth Management.
At the same time, media has become so pervasive, online and off, on TV and on our mobile phones, that many Americans say they are becoming victims of information overload. The more they watch, the less they know.
For sure, information overload is, I think, a serious threat to democracy, because it doesn't work if people aren't vigilant. Nobody's going to hold members of Congress accountable for you. You have to make sure that you're heard. I think there's also the sense that because there is this tension, and some would say healthy tension, between concern about protecting the process, democracy, and government from money's undue influence versus protecting freedom of speech and privacy. Nobody wants to censor information. We want our representatives to have all the information, even if it's coming from deep-pocketed corporations, unions, or trade associations, very narrow interests. We just want to make sure that they are doing their job to seek alternative perspectives, even if they're coming from groups that have no power and have no money.
Media criticism tends to revolve around what's being covered and not covered, and not on the way media narratives shape how we think and what we think about. That's the power of media and why it is now among the forces ruling America. Coming up in the next episode of Who Rules America, money now controls politics. Next time on Who Rules America.
In the limelight.
U.S. political and military leaders are allergic to admitting failure.